Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio.
Hello, you're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Zoe Grunewald.
And me, Ali Milani.
Coming up on today's show, Keir Starmer has resigned as Prime Minister. We'll discuss the latest with Labour stalwart John McDonnell. And a little later on, we'll hear an exclusive archive interview with Andy Burnham, which could give us some insight on his current policies.
As always, you can find us at Politics Uncensored UK on social media. But first, it's the Week Unwrapped.
I should just say...
Can we just start and talk about your Frank Sinatra voice situation?
Yeah, I'm sorry, everyone. I have laryngitis. Whenever I used to get ill, I'd always get like a blocked nose. Now, ever since I started speaking for a living, it's my voice that goes. And it's incredibly annoying. And you know, Ali, they say you have to rest your voice, which is just, it's just like a phrase. I don't know what that means.
So you've come on to host a radio show. Do you know what, do you remember that episode of Friends when, what's her name?
Phoebe.
Phoebe gets that voice. That's currently what it
sounds like. Yeah. So I did a podcast on, I mean, also the worst week for it to happen because the Prime Minister's resigned.
Yep.
I did a podcast on Monday for a Canadian audience and I apologised for my voice after, and the host said, don't worry about it, you're British and husky, they're going to love it. Anyway, let's talk, because this is, every week is huge politically, but this week is massive, okay? After months of mounting pressure, mainly from this radio station, Keir Starmer resigned as Prime Minister on Monday after just 23 months in office. Here is what he had to say in a speech outside Downing Street.
Every decision I've taken has been about putting the country I love first. That is why I will resign as leader of the Labour Party.
Andy Burnham has now confirmed that he will stand in the Labour leadership contest following his dramatic victory in the Makerfield by-election last week. Who'd have thunk it? With support reportedly growing amongst Labour MPs and senior ministers, many now believe he is on course to become Britain's next Prime Minister. Ali, you seem a good person to have in the room to talk about this.
I don't know what you're talking about. I wasn't there. I wasn't involved.
Sure.
Where is Makerfield?
Yeah, where is Makerfield? What do you think? Could Andy Burnham be the next Prime Minister?
Andy Burnham is the next Prime Minister. I think, there was two ways that this was going to go. Keir Starmer the whole time had said that he was going to contest a leadership race, as had Wes Streeting. Those were the kind of two, hotly tipped people to run against Andy Burnham. Even in that scenario, the polls suggest Andy would have won. Keir Starmer, I think as a result of the scale of the victory in Makerfield, there was always a question as to, can Andy win, for one? And then the second question is, what's the scale of that victory? Mm. Is he going to just kind of sneak through, or is he going to have a comprehensive, convincing victory? The Makerfield by-election was clearly in the latter. He got 55% of the vote, which was more than Reform and Restore put together, which was always, I think, partly the goal. Mm. And I think that's what kind of pushed things for Keir Starmer, to which he wouldn't contest the leadership election and caused him to resign.
What did you make of Keir Starmer's resignation speech?
In some ways, you know, it was a legacy speech. Mm. He talked through what his government had accomplished and the things that were really, really important to him. It's clear that he wants his legacy to be sort of first Labour leader to win a majority in the House of Commons in 14 years. And then his legacy, he wants to be the sort of country first, party second, which is something that he's continuously said. I thought it was quite short. Obviously, the main headlines was him getting emotional towards the end. I'm less sympathetic towards that, given how he treated people, a lot of people in the party, friends of mine, colleagues. But you always feel someone's personal emotional moment, particularly when he's talking about his family. So that's, you know, there's no doubt that he loves his family and loves his kids. And this has been a stressful, a difficult time for them. But just on the question of Andy Burnham, there's no, once Wes Streeting threw his weight behind Andy Burnham, it was over.
Yeah.
The leadership election was over. There isn't going to be a contest. There was rumours about, there are some in the party who think there should be a contest because Andy's ideas should be tested. I know Nadia Whittam has said that. And I know Al Carnes is kind of flirting with the idea of running. Darren Jones's name had come up, but he's kind of put that to bed. There's no question now Andy Burnham will be Prime Minister by September. Mm. The real question is who will be the team around him, both in the cabinet, in number 10, et cetera, et cetera. And that's, I think, where the real stories will line up in the next kind of weeks and months. We've already heard that James Purnell is going to be the chief of staff. And that's basically confirmed, I think. And there will be very senior roles for people like Ed Miliband. I assume Wes Streeting will also get a role. What did you think of Keir's speech? I should have asked you that.
I'm sick of watching prime ministers cry at the podium during their resignation every few months. Yeah. I know. Well, you know, like, maybe I'm just an empath. I hate to see people cry. And I agree. Keir Starmer didn't help himself. But there is something kind of, I don't know, there was something quite profoundly human about that moment. And I think Keir Starmer made a lot of mistakes, and I agree he couldn't continue on as prime minister. But I think there is clearly, and we've spoken about this before on the show, a deep sickness in our country that means we are churning through so many prime ministers so very quickly.
You've raised that on the show before. Is Britain ungovernable? Right, how can you churn through this many prime ministers, or if we just had had some bad ones?
I'm gonna just say, because we need to move on, but we can't even touch on the fact that this week was the 10th anniversary of Brexit, which I would say is the biggest underlying cause of all this instability. Not only are we in an economic doom loop because of the self-inflicted idiocy of leaving the single market, the customs union, but we have also permanently caused this massive fissure in our nation's psyche, which has led to the rise of reform. It's left so many unanswered questions about immigration, so much anger towards elites, experts.
Well, did you see what the official spokesperson?
All prime ministers are doomed.
For the European Union said, the official spokesperson for the European Union said that Britain would be welcomed back, or that there are, if we were to put in an application to return, it would be received warmly.
Well, listen, we're going to be talking all about Burnham in the second half of this episode, and I'm sure we'll get into that. I've got a little exclusive archive interview I'm going to play a little teaser of now, just to give you a taste, just to keep listeners holding on.
Labour has been stuck in the Westminster bubble for far too long. I'm the person to change that.
So we'll be unpacking that with the MP John McDonnell a little later, so do stay tuned.
I started to get flashbacks there when I heard his voice.
Okay. You remember who he is now?
Yeah.
Some other stories from this week for now that you might have missed. King Charles has become the first monarch in modern times to reveal his personal tax bill. His tax payments are expected to be shared on Thursday and will show the figures covering the 2024 to 2025 financial year. Buckingham Palace said the move was part of a modernising drive for greater transparency. Ali, this is quite unusual, isn't it?
Can I embarrass myself? Or maybe this isn't embarrassing. Maybe it is. I don't know. I didn't know they paid taxes.
Well, okay. He doesn't pay income tax or inheritance tax or capital gains tax. But he does pay some tax.
What is he paying?
So it's a good question.
We're gonna go through this.
He voluntarily pays income tax and capital gains tax on any sale of private assets.
But they're not obliged to pay income.
No, they're not obliged to pay tax.
So the sovereign grant has risen to a record £137.9 million, with a temporary increase used to pay for the renovations of Buckingham Palace. Let's talk about the reason why he's doing this. There's clearly the monarchy has been in trouble for a while, and that's predominantly Andrew's doing. And so there has been sort of an attempt by King Charles to modernize, to bring the sort of institution into the sort of 21st century, if you will, and this is clearly a driver in that. Do you think this is indicative of worries that the monarchy has about whether it's still relevant and
I think it's
whether
about
it holds public support?
I think it's about trying to use sunlight as disinfectant, you know, basically to say all the mistakes we made with Andrew we're not going to make again, and this is part of that wider drive. But I think my feeling is the issue with the royal family. Yes, they You know, you can't FOI the royal family. Did you know that?
No,
they're exempt from FOIs. They're exempt from paying taxes if they don't want to. It's not just the lack of transparency. It's the sort of entitlement and hierarchy. And that is so baked in now. So Prince William apparently is on this drive to kind of tell his staff and tell royal staff, you know, I want you to be honest with me. I want you to tell me and to challenge me. But I don't, there's that kind of thing of like, well, you can say that, but we are a country that is absolutely hamstrung by our deference to monarchy. It's going to take decades of unlearning, generations of unlearning, to have people who are willing to challenge the royal family. It's not just as simple as publishing your tax bill.
Yeah.
You know, it is a culture shift. And I do think King Charles is trying, but I think it's going to take a lot more than a tax bill.
Yeah, and I also, I mean, the beef that most people have had with the monarchy in the last couple of years has been on Andrew and other things. And when he went to the States, he didn't meet with any of the Epstein victims.
Mm. And all the trade envoy logs were public.
None of that's been touched. I have a specific question on this.
Yes.
So I've been desperately trying to find out what he paid last year. But of course, the headline is it's the first time he's going to do it. So that's a little bit silly. But I'm reading this as it's the first time he's going to reveal his personal tax bill, which means they must have been paying tax
for a while. He can, I think he voluntarily pays.
And has been for a while, right?
Yes. He voluntarily pays income tax and capital gains tax on any sale of private assets. But as you say, we don't know how much that is. And we know that they have a lot of private assets.
Yeah, I'm baffled by this. Mm. So, I wonder how much it's going to be.
Yeah, well, you have to stay tuned. And on Thursday.
But do you not think, surely they would have thought this, if it's crazy amounts, it's a bad look, right? In like a cost of living crisis, that sort of stuff. Mm. So it won't be that much.
No, well, they've been paying it since 1993. So I don't know if we'll, maybe they'll be further. Maybe eventually they'll publish.
Let's do this. Let's guess.
Oh, I don't know. 100 million.
99 million.
Okay, yeah, perfect. Whoever wins has to buy ice creams next Thursday.
That's the cameras right there.
Okay, that's fine. Okay. this is a good story, Ali. I don't know if you spied this. The last story of the week. Sturgeon and Gove. Nicola Sturgeon and Michael Gove are teaming up for a reality TV war game. This week, Sky announced a new reality TV series, The War Game, which will see a host of political figures simulate a response to a Russian attack on the UK. Its main stars are ex-Conservative Minister Michael Gove and former First Minister of Scotland Nicola Sturgeon, who will serve as Prime Minister and Deputy Prime Minister, respectively. Also, I'm in it.
Are you in it?
Yeah.
You're joking.
And I'm in it
too. How have you just told me this on air?
I'm in it too. I'm in a minor role, but I am in it.
Tell me more. This is so exciting.
In this simulation.
You should throw this in at the last bit.
I was looking forward to it. Also, I've not told anyone, but I have had sign of set. I'm a minor role. I'm not sure how much we're going to be in it, but I am playing the role of head of press for the government during this crisis.
Zoe, this is so cool. So wait, obviously it's a reality TV show, but you play a role. So you're right.
I'm me, but in like Nicola Sturgeon is her, but she's playing the deputy prime
minister. Did you have a script?
No.
So you react to other stuff that's happening.
It's a simulation. So it's kind of like you have to believe that this is all happening.
I'm so excited.
Yeah.
And you're head of press.
Head of
press.
For
the government.
Yeah. So there's loads. It's quite the lineup. You've got Harriet Harman. You've got Anthony Scaramucci.
When is this on air? I want to make sure.
I don't think the release date has been announced yet.
I tell people I'm friends with a celebrity.
Do you want to know who's in it? Michael Gove, Nicola Sturgeon, Penny Mordaunt, Saeed Avarsi, Harriet Harman, Jim Murphy, Aisha Hazarika, General Sir Richard Barons, Kim Darroch, Christopher Steele, Lord George Robertson, and Anthony Scaramucci.
This is so cool.
Yeah.
And you're going to war with the Russians, right?
So
if the simulation was Iranians, I would have gone on a call.
Yeah. Well, exactly. It's set 6 months in the future. And it's a simulation that's been developed with leading academics and military and defence experts, including Sky News' defence editor, Deborah Hayes. And it's supposed to replicate the pressure of political decision-making at the highest level.
It's a good brief. I wouldn't have watched it otherwise without you because... Sturgeon and Gove weren't like leading for me.
Yeah.
But Zoe Grunewald is definitely a leader.
So what do you think of this idea of Michael Gove being the Prime Minister and Nicola Sturgeon being the Deputy Prime Minister?
I don't want to talk about you being in it. Okay.
I can't say too much. Yeah. So,
by the way, do you know, fuck this, do you know what happens? Do you know who wins and loses and stuff?
Yeah.
That's very cool. Michael Gove being Prime Minister is my anxiety dream nightmare. I will say that. Nicola Sturgeon, I've always been really impressed by. Mm. I remember, do you remember the election of, which one was the one Ed Miliband fought in? 2015?
Yeah.
I remember being like extremely impressed with her throughout the like leadership election and being like, I was surprised. Obviously, because of the Scottish nationalist bit, she had to only do that. But I think she would have had real success if she'd led like a national party, because in the debate and all the interviews, she was really impressive. Obviously, she's had her own problems since then with her husband, and how there's questions about how much she knew.
I have to say, and we're going to wrap up after this, but I have to say, working with these MPs, you forget how incredibly talented they all are at
who
speaking.
Can you say who impressed you?
They all impressed me. Oh, and honestly, lying. They're so fluent, the way they speak. It's amazing.
Yeah.
I just was in awe. But I can't say anymore. I'm worried I'm going to get myself in trouble if I say anymore. So let's just wrap up. Anyway, we've got a way more interesting person coming up.
If there's a season two and it's Iran, please.
I'll tell them. I will. Okay. That's it for the Week Unwrapped. Coming up after the break, Labour MP John McDonnell will be here to discuss more on Keir Starmer's resignation and the man set to be his replacement. Stay tuned.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio. Follow us at Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Zoe Grunewald.
And me, Ali Milani.
So we're going to be continuing with the big story of the week, which of course is Keir Starmer's resignation and what's next for the Labour Party. And joining us to tell us more is John McDonnell, Labour MP for Hayes and Harlington, and of course, former Shadow Chancellor. John, thank you so much for joining us.
Good to see you.
So John, in your view, and actually this is a really big question, and I think when people kind of look at Keir Starmer's premiership, there'll be lots of different answers of kind of what the original sin was or what was, you know, the eventual smoking gun. But it, just in your own words, John, why did Keir Starmer resign?
I'm melting here. It's too hot for questions like this. All right. Well, let me just go back. Keir Starmer, when he got elected as leader of the Labour Party, he got elected because people quite liked the programme he was putting forward. And the programme he was putting forward, I remember it. It was a 10-point plan that was drawn out of the manifesto that Jeremy Corbyn and myself and others wrote. And everyone thought, well, we might have lost the 2019 election, but here's someone who wants to pursue the same sort of programme and may be a bit more presentable to some sections of the population, therefore might be more electable. And I think there was an element of enthusiasm that built up around that. There was a new opportunity, but the problem was you discovered very, very quickly that, first of all, he dropped the whole programme. Mm. Then he introduced a sort of, I can't think of any other word, but sort of authoritarian regime within the Labour Party, so that when people were trying to point out, well, this policy isn't going to work or this is going to alienate people, anyone who did that was immediately isolated and, well, even disciplined. And as a result of that, we just started making huge political mistakes. And section by section of our support, we alienated, we lost their support. And so I think it started very early on. And then you realise that actually Keir really didn't have much of a sort of basic ideology to work from. And at the same time, he didn't really have a really strong base of support within the Labour Party. And eventually that would come to grief. So that's the sort of the long history of how this all developed. But you can't be in a situation where you introduce a series of policies where, you know, like the winter fuel allowance, you know, a Labour government attacking pensioners, or the disability cuts, or the two-child limit leaving children in poverty. He was doing things that no one expected a Labour government could do or should do. And then the link up with Mandelson, all the free gifts, the suits, the glasses and all the rest. And then what really angered people, including me actually, was when he made those statements about Gaza, and he withdrew some of them, but then didn't really do much in terms of tackling the genocide that was taking place. And so you can see how it built up, where people got to the point where they just got angry with him. And on the doorstep, when you're campaigning, or you're in political meetings, or I was having a residence meeting, even when I was going on, as I go on the bus to work in the morning, that I've never known that sort of anger or dislike about a Labour leader on this scale, on that depth. So that's how we got to where we were. And what really finished it was the local government elections were so bad in whole areas of the country. We got wiped, Labour got wiped out to reform. And then people woke up to how dangerous it is now that we could have a reform government. Mm. So I think that's what brought it to a head. Keir stood down. I said he would stand down. I think he knew that the writing was on the wall. He had to go. So he's done that. And now the issue is, where do we go from here? Because it's almost certain Andy Burnham's going to become the leader. So in some ways, what that does, it opens up the debate and discussion about policies and the political direction of the government from here on in. Mm. That's too long-winded, Zoe. I'm sorry about that.
I thought that was a brilliant,
John, can I,
brilliant analysis of where we are. Thank you.
John, I want to ask about that. First of all, what we're going to do, John, is we're just going to fly by the fact that you didn't answer the phone to me today. We're not going to address that issue on air, but I'll call you later and we'll figure out why you ignored me earlier today.
Ali, I'm deliberately avoiding you. Let's be honest about it.
That's why, that's why I caught you here on air.
If I hear any more about Manchester United and what a good season they had and all the rest of it, there's enough to push me over the edge, to be honest.
Well,
you annoy everyone with that, do you?
Well, you know, he's a Liverpool fan. That's the problem. Let's talk about that change, John, because the Labour Party doesn't, it's not like the Conservatives. We don't like changing leaders. Right. It's not something that we like to do, particularly in government. So it's a clear message of a change in tact, a change in direction. The sense that I get from members, and you may say the same is true with colleagues in the Parliamentary Labour Party, is it's not just about a change in leader, it's just about change in direction. What do you think that should look like? What is, if Andy was listening, what does that, because let's be honest, he's going to be the Prime Minister. What does that change in direction look like?
Okay, just go through it one by one, those points that you made. One is this issue about the culture of the Labour Party. There was a really good book quite some years ago by an author called Foote, and it was about the culture of the Labour Party, the norms of the Labour Party. And what he said was actually one of the strongest norms was loyalty to the leader. Quite remarkable. And that's gone from the beginning of our party when it was first founded. And it might be that part of that is the sort of, because we were founded as a working class party to change the world, really. So you're up against the establishment, and that engendered in people a sort of solidarity. And the solidarity wasn't just with those around you, it was also solidarity, those representatives that you elected, because you knew that they would come under such pressure. So that's been part of the norm, if you like, the Labour. So it takes something to remove a leader, and that showed you the depth of, well, the depths of disillusionment with Keir that there was. But it wasn't just about him personally, it was about the whole political direction, exactly as you said. And what happened was, is that he sort of went against the basic mission of the Labour Party. I was on a platform, Marianne Mazzucato, the other night, and was one of my advisors at one point. And she was always talking about missions, and it was driving me up the wall. But actually, it's true, the Labour Party mission was always about, and Tony Benn, one of the great leaders of the Labour Party, senior figures in the Labour Party, said basically it was this, that what we're about is an irreversible shift in the balance of wealth and power in our society in favour of working people. So it's about equality, it's about redistribution of wealth and income, but more importantly, it's about redistribution of power. And what Keir did, Keir flew in the face of that. And in fact, what we seem to be doing is really not redistributing wealth or income on any real, on any real stage, any real quantum. And that denial of tackling the two-child limit and then withdrawing the whip from some of us when we tried to do it really did anger people. It was the same with the winter fuel allowance on pensioners. So he sort of flew in the face of that. So what I think people are looking for to Andy Burnham is, will he get back to that historic mission of the Labour Party of tackling the sort of grotesque levels of inequality in our society. You know, we've got 60 billion, I think it is, billionaires now in our society, in this UK alone, and we've got 14.2 million people living in poverty, 4 million children, and yes, a large number of children, they think nearly a million now, living in near destitution. So will he tackle that inequality? And how does he do it? Well, it is about redistribution of wealth, it's the taxation system. But it is also about, will he do something about tackling the real problems of the cost of living problems people are facing up to? And I think there's a whole gamut of policies that he could do that, rent controls, even introducing some elements of energy price controls on a firmer basis. And again, to pay for that, making sure that you actually tax the corporations that are making such excess profits at the moment. So it's that sort of thing about, will he get us back to the role Labour governments have always played and should play, which is about tackling inequality in our society? Part of that, you know, is about the shift of power, and the way you shift power on the workplace is about trade union rights. Within the wider community, it's about ensuring you've got a democratic local government properly resourced and empowered. But it is also about ownership. Mm. So the things that Andy has been saying about the need for looking at public ownership of some of the basic essentials like water, like energy, and also like transport. Yeah, it flies in the direction of the way the Labour Party should be going.
John, do you worry? I mean, if Burnham gets in, he'll be our seventh Prime Minister in 10 years. Do you worry that there's something almost sick about our democracy now, where we are churning through leaders? I mean, I was saying to Ali, I'm sick of watching prime ministers resigning in tears at the podium. It feels like there's something happening here that means we're just burning through leaders. Do you think that is really, the ability to get over that is really within the grasp of just one individual, or is it something bigger about the system?
Well, we have to be careful about this debate, because some of this argument is coming from the right. You know, you've had so many leaders, is our democracy working? And then from the right, they start questioning the whole process of democracy itself. Mm. And that's what worries me about those sort of comments, that sort of debates, from where those comments come from. But I actually say it does say something about how we've really not enabled people to engage in politics, and that we haven't enable them to do that. And what's happened is, if we don't do that in our communities at every aspect, if we don't do that in our workplaces, we'll enable people to really get involved in decision making that will affect their lives. Well, what happens is they just walk away from decision making. The number of people voting at general elections is declining. It has declined fairly rapidly over the last 30 years. And they sort of leave it to an elite group of politicians that just rotate between politics and making themselves, lining their pockets in corporations, or they all falling out amongst themselves. So I think it does say a bit about us not ensuring that we have a thorough and thriving democracy. And democracy isn't about just casting your vote every 5 years. It's actually having a real say in your in your local community. It's having a real say at work. I was in a meeting yesterday with a group of people who've been organising assemblies, local community assemblies and things like that, where people are brought together and they have a thorough discussion about the issues in their area, and then they go off and they lobby their local council. And what people were saying is, that's all well and good, but actually they need proper resourcing, they need proper accountability by their local councillors, that sort of thing. And what we do in this country is, we don't encourage that sort of democratic engagement. That would bring a stability to politics, because it wouldn't matter how long a prime minister survived. The issue would be how the system is operating itself. It's a bit like some of the things years back that we were trying to do on the GLC, which was to empower local communities. So, and then the rotor of leaders, I think, becomes almost irrelevant, because people are then in control themselves. The other issue as well, we have this first-past-the-post system. I have to get this in. We have a first-past-the-post system, which actually is not particularly democratic. And that's why Andy Burnham, actually, he has mentioned proportional representation. It's a big debate, and I think I'm supportive. I think it would give us a fairer form of representation. Mm. What he said is, he can't introduce it immediately. It needs to go into any manifesto, and then into in the next election. I agree with that, because if you try to do it now, the House of Lords would block it anyway. But if it's in the manifesto you're elected on, they can't block it.
Okay. Thank you for that, John. We're going to, after the break, we're going to unpack more of Andy Burnham's key policy points. Obviously, you're going to stay with us. It'd be great to have you there. So stay tuned and join us then.
FUPAR Radio. It's Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald with Politics Uncensored. FUPAR Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Zoe Grunewald.
And me, Ali Milani.
And John McDonald, of course, is still with us. How are you doing, John?
Good, good, good. Melting, but go on.
Okay, so as we were talking about before the break, everything seems to be pointing to Andy Burnham being the next Prime Minister. On Tuesday, he held a private meeting with Keir Starmer, and Cabinet ministers have been calling for a swift transition. And as of yet, no other MPs have thrown their hat in the ring. Ahead of the 2015 Labour leadership election, which Burnham ultimately lost, FUPAR spoke to him about the key issues he wanted to tackle if he became leader. We're going to hear a few clips of the interview across this section, but I guess I want to ask both of you very quickly, given that Andy Burnham was speaking to us about leading the Labour Party more than a decade ago, how long has he been waiting for this moment? Ali?
Well, can I ask John a question specifically that, if that's okay? John, you were very instrumental in Jeremy's leadership campaign in 2015, so obviously you would have interacted with Andy then. What was he like then?
Okay, good question. Let me tell you the story very quickly. Andy was seen as close to Gordon Brown at that time. And actually, he was quite similar to who he is now, where he was always open for a chat and open person. So someone you got on well with. And when Ed Miliband stood down, which was a bit of a shock, it all came as a shock. He lost the election and then stood down immediately. I wanted him to stay on, but he stood down. Andy was one of those people who put their name forward to stand as leader. From the left, we met with lots of groups and told them, look, we don't think we're going to be able to get a left candidate on the ballot paper. So we think the best thing to do is to swing behind Andy Burnham, because actually what we can do is possibly negotiate a policy programme that's we think is more appropriate for what our people need, and also maybe get a few positions for the left on the Labour front bench. Then what happened was there was a vote on Social Security, and it was very similar to some of the Social Security plans that Starmer was putting forward. And what happened was Andy abstained rather than voted against. And so then we thought, well, sorry, we can't back you. And then we had to go back and say, no matter how tough it is getting someone on the ballot paper, someone's got to stand. And we sat around in a small committee room, went round the table of the left, and were forcing someone to volunteer. And Jeremy, with his arm twisted up his back, said, oh, all right then. And we ran the campaign thinking that actually we may pick up about 20% of the vote, something like that, demonstrate the left's still alive. And then, blow me, he won. Yeah, and that was it. So, and I think Andy, actually, he didn't do very well in that election. But I think if he'd have voted the right way on that one Social Security piece of legislation, he most probably would have been leader. That was a tragedy of it for him. But I think since then, I think he's, I don't say grown up, but I think he's matured into someone who understands a bit more the nature of the Labour Party and the need for the Labour Party to be what we think, we say a broad church, respect for everyone in it, left, right and centre. So I think he's that sort of person that wants to work with everyone. I have no illusions about different aspects of what he'll be doing, and some things that will support, some things we won't, but at least he's going to open up the space for a proper debate and discussion, a respectful one, rather than under Keir, where you know, if you object to something, they withdraw the whip, or they stop you from standing again, or they block you, that sort of thing.
Okay, John, we want to play some of these clips. And I want to get your kind of quite quick reactions to them, because we've got a few we want to get through. So the first of these is about Andy Burnham's views on Westminster. Here we go.
But I'm pretty confident that what I'm saying is what Labour needs. Labour has been stuck in the Westminster bubble for far too long. People aren't relating to us anymore. They're just thinking we're just hopelessly out of touch. I'm the person to change that.
Does he still make that argument today, do you think, John? Does that still stand? I think that's very much part of Burnham's Burnham's narrative now.
I think it does still stand. It is easy to get trapped in that Westminster bubble. Although individual MPs work hard in their constituencies, most do, it is easy to just get your focus on just the ins and outs of Westminster politics rather than out in the community. I think he'll be a breath of fresh air in that respect. He's talking about, actually he's endorsing one of the policies, Ali, if you can remember, I was advocating, where actually government departments, even parts of Number 10, you spread around the country, so they're really based in the regions and cities where they need to be and where they can start listening and engaging with people.
Did,
so
John,
I think he's right, yeah.
You did your economic tour, didn't you, where you would meet, do these like community centres all around the country? Because I think the sense is that London has too much power, and I got that sense in Makerfield.
Well, virtually every Saturday I would tour around with my treasury team and we'd have organised community meetings and we'd talk about developing a local economic strategy, and people would come in saying, this is what we think should happen. We'd say, great, why don't you write it up, because you're going to implement it at the local level. But also, we were setting up a national investment bank and I wanted that up north. You can guess what northern city I would have gone for, Ali, can't you, really? Somewhere where I think people talk with a lovely accent in the northwest, that
terrible
sort of thing.
Football teams,
but also I was going to make sure we had regional offices, the Bank of England, that sort of thing. So they we had regional investment banks planned, so they'd be embedded in the local region. I do think Andy will go along that path. I think he is someone who now understands the nature of local and regional government better than most others.
Mm. Yeah, I guess his experience as mayor of Greater
Manchester, mayor,
so embeds that. I think that's, it kind of feels like a lot of his sell will be about trying to move power away from Westminster, which will be very interesting. Let's talk about immigration, because obviously this is one of the defining issues for many voters. It was at the recent local elections, just as it was in the 2024 general election. Back in 2015, Burnham argued that Labour needed to take voters' concerns more seriously. Here's what he said.
We've got to think about people who voted Labour in the past who are not doing so anymore. Now, I would say at the last election, many of those people went to UKIP. And I don't think, you know, that's the Jeremy Corbyn message that's necessary going to win them back. I mean, they feel, not that we're not left-wing enough, they feel that we're just out of touch. They see the effects of immigration in their communities from Europe in terms of people's jobs and the undercutting of wages and the pressure on primary schools and GP surgeries. And they see people come on the telly like me saying, oh, immigration's purely a good thing. And they think, well, do you know what? That person is completely out of touch with my life. And I think that is the problem we've got as a Labour Party.
This is an interesting one, isn't it? Because immigration has been so important in the national conversation. But there are a lot of people who feel that Keir Starmer's willingness to kind of debate immigration on the same terms, you know, to accept reform's terms of the debate, ultimately has been one of the most, one of the worst decisions for him, because it's isolated a lot of that core vote that were responsible for getting him into Downing Street and would be responsible for doing so at the next election. When you hear Burnham make those remarks, does it worry you? Does it sound reminiscent of Keir Starmer?
Yeah, I think he's out of date, really, on that, Andy. And yeah, I think he's just got it wrong. It's interesting, though, because in that clip, he was referring to European immigration as well, wasn't he? Well, that's virtually gone because of Brexit. That's absolutely collapsed. And as a result of that, our economy has suffered. It's quite remarkable. I think my view on immigration is fairly straightforward. You're talking to the grandson of an Irish immigrant, you know. And so the argument about immigration, you have to be honest with people, is that actually migration has meant that we've grown an economy, and generation after generation of migrants that have come here have all made a significant contribution. So let's have a conversation about what the real issues are. And if the real issues are about wages being cut, well, the problem there is not about immigration. It's about lack of trade union rights and power in the workforce. If it's about our public services being overwhelmed, well, it's got nothing to do, with immigration. It's got to do with the years of austerity have undermined those public services. And if it's about lack of housing, it's as a result the sell-off of council houses and the lack of a council house programme. So what we've got to do is address the real issues that people face, and then it's a matter then is where immigration doesn't become the way, it doesn't become an issue that can be used for political advantage largely by the right. It's as simple as that, as far as I'm concerned.
And do you have confidence that Andy Burnham now will make those arguments?
We'll see. One of the issues we're trying to engage with him at the moment, and here's a classic example. We have people who come here on work visas, and they come here, and often they're doing jobs that we find difficult to recruit people to. Social care is the big one. Mm. Huge number of people coming to work in social care. And in fact, if they weren't here, our social care would collapse, certainly in my constituency, I'm sure in many other areas. What's happened? Usually they've come, they'll be here for 4 or 5 years. They'll apply for permanent status because they've settled here. Often they've brought their family with them as well, and they'll be able therefore to be settled and continue to provide that service in our community. It's a wonderful resource. In some ways, it's overexploited because some of those people, unfortunately, are on low wages. I want to make sure if they come here, they've got decent wages. Mm. The government, the Tories want to block this, and what the Labour government under Starmer has done now is said that actually people might have to wait for 10 or 15 years before they get status. And that's just going to undermine the security of those workers. It'll prevent us attracting people here as well, because we can't offer them stability. So we've asked Andy Burnham to look at that, because what the Conservatives have done, they've said actually it applies to all those people who are here already. So I've got lots of care workers who came to see me in Parliament. In fact, there were 700 visited Parliament the other week. Some of them from my constituency said, well, look, we've been here 4 years. We're about to apply to a permanent status. And now we're going to have to wait maybe 10 or 15 years. And it just undermines, well, people's not just future, undermines their immediate security. So we've asked him to look at that again, and we're hoping to meet him next week. If he prevents that being sort of retrospective for all those people who are here already, I think that's a major advance. I'm hoping we can persuade him on that. If we don't, the problem that we've got is that some of our services are actually under threat. I'll give you another example. The government has had to shift on this one. The prison officers came along and saw the minister and said, actually, we've got 1,000 prison officers on these work visas. Mm. They were recruited in Africa. And if you send them back, some of our prisons will cease operating. So the government had to then look at how they changed the rules to accommodate them. So I'm hoping there's that flexibility with Andy Burnham as well.
Mm. Okie doke. Let's talk about housing, because housing affordability remains one of the biggest challenges facing voters, particularly younger voters who want to get on the property ladder but increasingly feel locked out of home ownership. Well, back in 2015, Burnham argued that giving more power to local government was part of the solution. Here's what he told FUBAR.
You know, I think we had a politics in this country for too long where London and Westminster has tried to control everything else in the country. It's wrong. Free up councils to build so they can build the council housing, the affordable housing that local places need. And then I'm going to bring through an idea called rent to own. So those new places that we build, allow people to start renting them on a very long-term lease, but then eventually they can own those properties at the end of it. So you take away the problem of trying to get a deposit together, which obviously isn't possible for many young people who are paying off university fees and all the rest of it.
John, there he talks about affordable housing and freeing up councils to build. That's the sort of devolution element. Where he's talking about differently now is a massive council house building program. I heard him say that on the, on the doorstep quite a lot. Does that ring true with the sort of stuff that you think needs doing?
It's the only way we're going to tackle the housing crisis. There's another report out today which demonstrates actually the government is not delivering on the numbers at all. Steve Reid, who's the minister responsible, he's relied upon the private sector to build. And what's happening, particularly in areas like mine, is the private sector aren't building because their charges are so high that people can't afford them. So the only way we'll tackle the housing crisis is, first of all, getting a huge council house building programme going again. And actually, interestingly enough, since the Second World War, both political parties have built council houses on substantial sale. And the reason we've got a crisis in housing at the moment is because, you know, the Conservative government under Margaret Thatcher sold them off. Mm. And what she promised is that when they sell them off, that money will be reinvested to build more houses so we don't have a housing crisis. What happened was they sold them off and then didn't use that money to build new ones. So I think it's exactly right. Council house programmes are absolutely the solution. The problem that we've got is that under-resourced local councils, and we've got to build that resource up again.
John, can I?
But in the immediate future, there's two things I'd like to see happen. First of all, do what Sadiq Khan and actually Andy called for when they were mayors, and that's rent controls. We desperately need rent controls. And the other thing is, come from a meeting today with regard to Young leaseholders in my constituency, and what's happening with them is that they're being absolutely battered with service charge increases, you know, sort of 300% over the last 3 years. And again, so we've got to introduce legislation to control service charges. Now, the government has brought forward a leaseholder bill. It's a draft bill at the moment. It doesn't deal with those service charge issues. So it would be relatively easy to bring in an amendment to that legislation, which would cap service charges and give people more control. And then eventually end leasehold once and forever.
John, thank you so much. We've just covered an awful lot of ground there. I appreciate you coming on and helping us. That, of course, was John McDonnell, Labour MP, former Shadow Chancellor. John, join us next time.
Yeah, and answer your phone.
Brill, Ali, lots to unpack there from John.
Can I just say, I think one of the things that's striking about that is Andy Burnham has both made the case and is clear in the sort of politics he spoke about in the Makefield by-election and has spoken about in the last sort of 2 years, is a very different politician to the one in 2015. In 2015, or at least that's how he's sort of presented himself. In 2015, he was very much a sort of successor to the Gordon, pretty much he was Brownite, like a successor to the New Labour project, if that makes sense. And he was seen as the one of the sort of golden childs of that generation, was kind of defeated by Jeremy Corbyn, not kind of, was defeated by Jeremy Corbyn pretty resoundingly, went back to Manchester and seems to have come back to London now, a very different politician. And that's definitely how he's sold himself, how he's presented himself, the story that he's telling. He's also kind of presenting himself now as an outsider. I think that's going to be the key challenge of Andy Burnham as Prime Minister. It's one thing to be like an insurgent outsider as Mayor of Manchester. It's very difficult to govern as an insurgent outsider. Donald Trump has tried it, but
The thing that worries me about Andy Burnham, I don't know if I said this to you already, is that I feel because he has been a lot of things to a lot of people. You know, there's the joke about when Brownite, Blairite, Corbynite walks into a bar and the barman says, "What are you having, Andy?" Which I'm sure you've heard a lot. My worry is because he has, and you know, in many ways that makes him a very skilled politician. But my worry is that people are projecting whatever they think is missing from the Labour Party onto him. And I'm not convinced yet by what is clear Burnhamism. And I think there are probably a lot of promises being made to different camps that at some point some of them will have to give.
Yeah, I think one of the difficulties in the Labour Party is everyone has been so upset, every camp has been so upset for so long, they've all put their hopes and dreams into him. And he is going to disappoint probably a majority. Given that the number one criticism Keir Starmer consistently got is we don't know what you believe in. I think if in the first 100 days Andy is not able to define clearly and tell the story clearly to the population what he believes in and what this government is about, then I think he's in deep trouble.
Okay, really quick question. Give me one policy Andy Burnham should introduce in his first 100 days. And bear in mind, 100 days, it needs to be like quick and effective.
Nationalised Thames Water.
Okay.
I think it tells the story. I think that tells the story of how Westminster has taken the mick out of ordinary folk. I think it tells the story of nationalisation. I think it tells the story of real Labour values, insurgency, being different and being disruptive, everything. What about you?
Ban second jobs.
Yeah.
Because not only does it do the whole, like, no more take it on the take, no more stories of hypocrisy, no more self-interest, it also makes Mr. Nigel Farage, who had £2 million in additional earnings, have to go on the radio and the TV and defend why he should still be able to take £2 million.
Did you see Nigel Farage do that interview with Nick Ferrari and others on GMB about the £5 million and how he spent it? It was crazy. It was like, none of your business. I could buy Ferraris.
Oh, I did see that. He's definitely flailing, and I think Burnham needs to take the fight.
He's now lost a few by-elections. There's chinks in that armor.
Yeah. Okie doke. Well, that is it from Politics Uncensored today. Join us next Thursday at 5 p.m. where we unwrap the week's political talking points.
You can stay up to date with the show by following Politics Uncensored UK on social media, where you can find me at Ali Milani.
And you can find me at Zoe Grunewald.
If you've missed any of today's show, you can listen back and catch up at FUBARadio.com or via the FUBAR Radio app.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week, hopefully with a more resounding voice, for another episode of Politics Uncensored.
FUBAR Radio.